year of my life. That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM, this March 7th, 2017 edition, episode 103 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico, and also from the Maya Mountains of Belize, and from New Zealand, where our upcoming guest is, and from the PRN studios in New York City. Our thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution. We'll be taking calls today. Please dial us up toll free at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Our guest today was recommended by friend of the show and tour extraordinaire Kevin Hester. Stephanie Steven is a musician who, along with her husband Scott, are living in a motorhome traveling and producing songs, and are also very much living in nature and as simple as possible. Stephanie writes, "It's really exciting for me as a songwriter to get my music played. After sending this little Facebook note to Kevin, it just went crazy. Hundreds of people listened to The World Is Dying on the weekend. I started to use social media only in January of this year, and mainly to see how it all works. It was a good choice to be positive about, though, because I could connect with people who are like-minded and share similar ideas. So what would I like to say about my song? Well," Stephanie writes, "if I was Bob Dylan, I would say it's about 4 minutes. But I'm just a girl who saw The Inconvenient Truth, a documentary that really inspired me to produce this song. I've been a singer and an entertainer all of my life, and I've worked with some of the best musicians all over the world. But learning to play the guitar and writing an album traveling with our motorhome through New Zealand, using as little technology as possible, was a dream that is now a reality. One of my songs only recently reached number 15 in the top iCharts of the United States. The song is not as sad as The World Is Dying, but rather gives a little hope that we can find The Door," the name of the song. "Unfortunately, we need more people in politics that support the scientists rather than fighting them. Right now, it feels like the Day After the Day After Tomorrow movie, where the big man does not want to hear about the weather problems." Welcome to Nature Bats Last, Stephanie.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
I can hear you great.
I'm very good, actually. We have a bit of a rain, and you can probably hear it. It's trickling down on the motorhome. pouring down, actually.
Oh, it's a very soothing sound.
Okay, that's all right.
Yeah. So your song, The World Is Dying, has been getting some extra airplay after Kevin introduced it to our little community here. Has there been some feedback to the song itself?
Yes, I had a lot of feedback, actually. A lot of people are wanting to use it on radio stations for climate change programs. And so, for example, Zandra Kyle already used it in her Safe and Sound program. And it's actually incredible what happened after I sent this little message to Kevin. Because all this information came in for the last 3 weeks, and we really studied what happens in the world. Yeah. And the climate change is so obvious. And then watching Guy McPherson's presentation in Wellington, I just saw this on YouTube, but boy, we're just absolutely stunned and shocked what is happening. And how much does have to happen in the world until someone's actually really doing something in politics and acknowledging it?
Absolutely. Guy, are you there?
Yes, thank you. And thank you for that introduction, Mike, and for joining us on the air, Stephanie. And you bring up a good question. How much will it take before people begin to do something? I think Tim Garrett from the University of Utah, where he's an atmospheric scientist, I think his work comes into play here. He pointed out in an article written in 2007 and denied publication by 10 different refereed journal articles that only collapse of civilization prevents runaway climate change. There's not a lot of people who want to embrace the idea of collapse of industrial civilization. So if that's what it means to do something, I don't think you'd get a lot of government officials involved with that project.
Probably not. I really want to play the song for the audience, and then we can kind of go from there, and then we can talk about the video that you made for the song recently as well. So if we could get the studio to play The World Is Dying, and then we'll give some questions after that.
Okay.
The world is dying. It's melting the ice. The world is dying right in front of your eyes. Why are we so blind to see and turn away? The world is dying today. Billions are wasted on weapons and war, and nobody really knows what they're fighting for. Shooting and killing seems to be the game to play. The world is dying today.
That we should prepare against other threats besides terrorists. Our ability to live is what is at stake.
The world is dying. Goodbye, paradise. The world is crying. And we cover our eyes. Oh, why are we so blind to see and turn away? The world is dying today.
The biggest crisis in the history of this country.
Early this morning, Hurricane Katrina slapped into New Orleans.
Is experiencing faster melting. If this were to go, sea level worldwide would go up 20 feet. This is what would happen in Florida. Around Shanghai, only 40 million people. The area around Calcutta, 60 million. Here's Manhattan. The World Trade Center Memorial would be underwater.
Tsunamis and hurricanes are a mother earth sign that nature is battling world's biggest crime. Plagues and pollution caused by the human disease. It's no surprise that the world demands peace.
Okay, that is The World is Dying. Stephanie, you could talk a little bit about, you know, you mentioned we can hear Al Gore's voice from An Inconvenient Truth, and we hear a little bit about Katrina in there, and both of those are well over a decade ago, and obviously the world isn't getting any better. I could talk about a little bit of the genesis of where the song came from.
Yeah, okay. When I watched that movie, The Inconvenient Truth, I was just so moved from it, and usually my songs are happy and but that was so different, so different to write something like that. But I was inspired and I thought, I'll just do this. And as I'm traveling in a motorhome, I don't have a studio and just do it with little technique as possible. So it's probably musically not perfect, and I just copied a few scenes out of The Inconvenient Truth into the song, as you can hear. But I thought it's just about the message, to get the message across to the world, to the people. And I think that's, yeah, it's a bit chaotic, and I think it is a bit like what the climate change is as well. It's chaotic.
Right. So how old is the song itself?
Probably 2 years.
Okay. So obviously, you know, the movie is the movie came out in 2006. Katrina happened in 2005. This stuff has been on your mind for some time, and you know, you wrote a song about it, and you're living your life differently than most people in the world are. Most people that are born into industrial civilization, you're not necessarily pursuing the same things. Talk a little bit about, you know, the combination of realizing these things and the life choices you've made.
Yes, okay, Mike, that's quite simple. We were living in Germany for about 10 years, my partner and I, and yeah, we had this dream to tour New Zealand and to see where we want to live in future, because we actually already were aware of what's happening in the world, and it's also the refugees and whatever the changes in the world. So we decided to come back to New Zealand. My man is a New Zealander, and then move around in the motorhome. And I always had this dream to write an album, and so that's why this came together now. And the song "The World Is Dying" was one of the first that I then put together. Mm-hmm. And it's now it's a lifestyle to live in a motorhome is unusual for a lot of people. And yeah, we play a lot of tennis and pretty much enjoy our life, as you know. And now having all this information, you know, we just do the best with it. And I think that's where Guy McPherson has a good saying to say, just, you know, enjoy, and you don't have to kill yourself, but you know, you just live with what you got, and it's just the essence of life to be, you know, do what you do with excellence.
Well, based on your music, I'd say you're doing that, Stephanie, and it seems that you're pursuing a simpler existence than you were before. We do have a call. Steve from Arizona, do you have a question for our guest, Stephanie, or do you have a question for us?
Well, I was wanting to ask a question. Okay. And did you work at the Biosphere at all? Are you there?
Yes. Yes, I advised graduate students who worked in the Biosphere. In fact, one of the original Biospherians, I was on his graduate advisory committee, so I got to know him reasonably well, and I'm familiar with the Biosphere. I've been there with Biosphere, too. I've been there many times. Stephanie, if you don't mind, we're going to take a few seconds to respond to this caller, and then we'll get back to questions with you, and hopefully
our next
we'll have questions for you as well. So go ahead, Steve. You have a question?
Yeah, my biggest question is about water in the area. Did they tap into a well below the Biosphere for their water?
You know, I don't know where the water came from. There were some very interesting conclusions from a scientific perspective that came out of Biosphere 2. They, for example, had essentially access to infinite fossil fuels, and yet all eight of the original Biospherians virtually starved to death. They all lost a lot of weight, suggesting that the human carrying capacity of the planet in the presence of infinite fossil fuels would be somewhere between 6 and 8 billion people. We're at 7.5 billion now, so that doesn't bode all that well for humans on the planet, given that fossil fuels are, in fact, limited. So I'm not sure where the water came from. There were many, many issues with Biosphere 2 as a living compound, despite the virtually unlimited amount of money that was thrown at the project and, as I indicated, essentially unlimited access to fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. When I moved here about 3 years ago, the sales office here had said that there's a 100-year aquifer below us here. And I'm wondering, with probably another 7,000 homes to be built in the area, how fast that could disappear A scientist at the biosphere told me that this aquifer is recharged by melting snows on Mount Lemmon, and it trickles down and goes through some fissures down below. But I thought about, what if Tucson runs out of water? Will they want our water, or vice versa? If we want to run out of water first, you maybe know something about the water situation in Tucson.
Yes, I do. I know quite a bit about it. And I've heard a lot of stories about 100-year aquifers, too. For example, when indigenous people were living in the Tucson Basin, there were two perennial rivers there. Those rivers flowed year-round. One of them came off the Santa Catalina Mountains, Mount Lemmon, as you already mentioned, which provides the water through melted snow. Or Oracle, which is where you're talking about now, where Biosphere 2 is located, in Oracle, north of Tucson. So there were two perennial rivers that seemed like they would last forever, and that's why Father Kino and other folks set up shop and established a mission there in Tucson, because after all, it was flowing above ground year-round. We've heard that story a time or two before. We've also heard about 100-year floods and 100-year atmospheric events that seem to be happening every year now, or every few years. So I wouldn't put a lot of stock into a 100-year aquifer that depends completely upon how many straws are stuck into it and how rapidly the water is being taken out, as well as how rapidly the aquifer is being recharged. So it could very well be that with a few hundred people, the depletion rate would not exceed the rate at which water is going into the aquifer, the recharge rate. But we're in the midst of abrupt climate change. The weather patterns that we are observing today, including the accumulation of snow on Mount Lemmon, is not guaranteed to persist into the future. Dry areas will tend to become drier. A recent paper from the Refereeing Journal literature indicates there's a 99% chance that the interior of the United States will be locked into a 1,000-year drought in the not-too-distant future as a result of simple, linear, gradual climate change. So I don't think we can count on that recharge rate being the same as it has been. And from what I've seen, based on my living in Tucson for 23 years and visiting for a few years afterwards, there's not a lot of slowing that rate down, the rate of depletion. There were many places in the middle of the city that the houses were collapsing because the ground was sinking as a result of depletion of the aquifer. That was in 2005 through 2015, and there hasn't been any significant effort to slow down the rate of depletion that I'm familiar with. So I don't think things are going to get a whole lot better. Rather, I think things are going to get a whole lot worse.
Yes. Did we learn anything significant from the biosphere? It seems to me that they had the carbon dioxide problem. I think it was from not sealing the concrete. Did we learn anything significant about the future from the biosphere?
Yes, we did. I already mentioned one of the things, that the human carrying capacity of the planet is probably somewhere around 6 to 8 billion people, with infinite access to fossil fuels. And of course, we are in the midst of fossil fuel depletion right now. We peaked in terms of conventional oil, crude plus condensate, in 2005 or 2006. Only the shale phenomenon has propped up the bubble for a little while longer. But as the depletion of fossil fuels continues, there is little question that the human carrying capacity will drop well below 6 to 8 billion people. And it appears, based on my understanding of abrupt climate change and habitat for humans, that we'll be a lot closer to zero than we will to 6 or 8 billion in the very, very near future. So I'd say the most important thing we learned is that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet, no matter how hard you're in. And obviously there were other less significant messages based on atmospheric chemistry, and particularly noteworthy is what you mentioned, carbon dioxide. We're having a hard time keeping the carbon dioxide in our atmosphere under control. It became potentially lethal in Biosphere 2, and they had to open the hatches and play with the mixture of air. Instead of keeping the hatches closed for two continuous years, they actually, the record was far less stellar than that. They closed the airlocks approximately every week to 10 days to see important things like air and chocolate bars and the really critical stuff. Human
Well, thanks for your call, Steve. We really appreciate it. All right.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed the call. Thanks. Bye.
Absolutely. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Stephanie, I wanted to get back to you and your conversation and your correspondence with Kevin Hester. And I guess what inspired that? Was that directed by you or him, or and what? Why did it take place?
When I finished my song, I thought, so what am I going to do with it? And I just wanted to get people to listen to it. And I somehow came across Kevin Hester's Facebook page, and what I read on his page was just unbelievable. And because living in New Zealand and he lives in, where is it, Rakino or something? I was just getting all this information. I thought this is a good guy to send the song to, and obviously it was. And so New Zealand is also not as green as you think it is. And you know, listening to this show with Sandra was also something about the water problem that we have in New Zealand. And I don't know, you probably know that they just recently changed the, I call it measuring stick, from what was a warning to go into a river swimming is now a swimmable river and stuff like that. I mean, there was a guy, Dr. Mike Joy, he was actually having a very, very detailed talk about what's happening in New Zealand waters. And so it's also not as green as you think it is. So, yeah, I guess Kevin Hester is just a big key player here in New Zealand if you look at climate change.
That's a great point. You know, we tend to believe what we want to believe as human beings for the most part. And so when somebody, especially somebody with access to advertising, to governments, large corporations, when those kinds of people are telling us that we're going green, that we're doing something really important, we tend to believe that because that's what we want to believe. Oh, if we just make these relatively minor changes, if we change how we shop, if we change how we spend our money, then it's all going to be okay, because that's the green version of disaster capitalism. So it must be better than the current version. But as we see all around us, and not just with respect to climate change, but with respect to how we treat the water and the soil and the air and how we treat other human beings, with respect to monetary policy, with respect to almost everything, it's all getting worse from one year to the next. There's no significant indicators of improvement, because it's all one kettle of fish. Mike Joy, the scientist you mentioned, has come closer than anybody else in that country to taking a radical approach to pointing out that capitalism has its costs, that this set of living arrangements has significant downsides. No matter what we wish, no matter what we believe, no matter what we think, as hard as we might think, that we're heading in this direction. We don't need to look very far to find out that we're spoiling the water and fouling the air. And it's just not, this whole set of living arrangements is not the green version of capitalism that we were hearing about in the 1960s and 1970s.
No, absolutely not. And I think it's something, it's pretty remarkable that, you know, we have Kevin and obviously Stephanie and Guy's done multiple tours, and there's multiple people in our community, our Nature Bats Last community, who are from New Zealand, from a place that is thought to be, you know, as far as worldwide view, to be this paradise. And yet the people that we're hearing from a great deal, the voices we're hearing from, like yourself, are telling us something different. And I think that is significant, that when the people that live in quote-unquote paradise are pointing out that it is not paradise, that's pretty alarming. And I find that interesting. What are your thoughts on that, Stephanie?
Well, to be what I like to say about that is I just watched a movie from a Maori guy. He was holding a water bottle taking out of a lake. What lake was it? It's a sample. Sorry, my English is not always the best. I'm German, and therefore I'm a bit struggling. But so this video, Hirini or something, someone like that it was, you find on Kevin Hees's website, I'm sure. Just watch it. It just breaks my heart to see this guy talking about New Zealand water and, where we are with this. And it's just so full of pollution and algae and, it's terrible, really. Yeah.
Well, I mean, your English is much better than my German, so you have nothing to apologize about. We can hear you fantastically. We're going to take another call. Gaio from Arkansas, do you have a comment or question for any of us?
Hi. Hear me?
Hey, Gaio. Thanks very much for calling in, buddy. Good to hear from you.
Hey, guys.
Again.
Hey, Stephanie. Hey, don't you think it's pitiful how few people really know we're dying, how short a time we have before extinction is on top of us? That's all I have to say, and I'm going to see you in Missouri in a couple months.
Awesome. Stephanie, would you want to take that on first? That's a pithy question if I've ever heard one, consistent with Gaio's style.
I'll see you later.
Yeah, well, I can't give you the date or the extinction date on that, of course, but after reading or listening to Guy's presentation, I believe it's not too far off, and so therefore you just have to enjoy as much as you can. So, I can't really answer that question. I'd rather give that to the professor.
Well, I think you've answered it pretty well, and that's what Guy and I have always tried to promote and promote personally as well in our own lives, just like you're doing. You know, you're not necessarily following the standard procedure, and there's pushback from that, at least it has been on our end. And I think once you see the people that are pushing back and you look at the lives and the way they're living their lives, you get an inkling that you're on the right track, and that's at least how it's worked for both of us. And I would assume that, you know, what you're doing is something that feels liberating, and that's why you're continuing to do it and live the way you are through, you know, your music and living on the road.
Yes.
And absolutely. And to more directly address the question Gaio asked, isn't it pathetic how few people know about near-term human extinction, about our ultimate demise? And it is, I wouldn't say pathetic, because there is such strong control exerted over the governments and the corporations of the world, which are pretty difficult to distinguish these days. I'd say it's a little surprising how few people are willing to listen to anything beyond the mainstream, whether it's media or governments. So I guess I'm surprised and disappointed by how few people are willing to acknowledge what is right in front of our faces based on evidence. But on the other hand, sometimes I'm surprised at my surprise, because I look at how long the system has been in decay and how long the dumbing down of our culture has been going on. And
yes.
So some days I'm amazed that I can speak to somebody and use English and have both of us understand the conversation.
Well, yeah, we don't even talk about death, you know, at least in the American culture, we very seldom talk about death itself, let alone extinction. So to make that leap for people can't even talk about, you know, death personally, let alone their species, I don't know. I used to think we'd be able to make that leap based on the information getting out, maybe people like Guy getting on some mainstream media outlets once in a while, but I don't know. Even if that did happen, there's such a denial of death in this culture. And I don't know what it's like in Germany or New Zealand. Maybe you could comment on that, Stephanie.
Well, I can only quote with Albert Einstein here. He says, you know, two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. And I'm not sure about the universe. I think that's just, yeah, probably we just all a bit stupid, or we don't want to believe that this is really happening. I mean, if I look out, right now it's raining, but if I look out in New Zealand and see this beautiful country, I also can't really believe this is happening, you know. But when you watch the facts and the science, then yeah, you can't really ignore it anymore.
You know, it's really interesting, that paradox, because most days it seems to me that I can't influence anything or anybody around me. I certainly am not having a significant impact on the 57 acres I occupy, on the tree outside the window that's scraping against the window all night. How could humans, given that there's relatively few of us, how could we be influencing something as complex as the thermostat of the entire planet? And yet, you only have to take a quick look around to realize that how we get our water and how we get our food, how we get and our air cleaned for us, that all depends on things that we have significantly adversely impacted. So it's really a paradox, our inability as individuals to exert any influence and our collective impact on the planet seem to be profoundly at odds with each other. Mike, you have a comment about that?
No, go ahead, Stephanie.
Just to interrupt, it's also that probably most people don't really have the time to think, because they're just, you know, working, trying to save enough money to pay their bills, and it's just a roller coaster they're on every day. And that's the difference with my husband and I. We have a bit of time to think and reflect on what's happening, and therefore see where this world is going. And it's not rocket science to calculate, you know, the billions of people. And I know it's probably not nice to say, but I see us a little bit like the virus on this planet. And it might not be nice to say, but anyway, I think it can't go on any longer. We're just too many. And
that's a great point. I mean, you bring up, it's an absolute privilege, and Guy and I have talked about this before. It's an absolute privilege to have the time to think about these things, because, you know, I'm not worried for my basic human needs. You know, I have food on the table, I have shelter, I have water, and I'm not, you know, I wasn't born into a refugee camp, and I'm not a migrant, and I'm not a refugee, and I'm not searching for a home. And so, yeah, those are things I have the privilege to think about. And at the same time, it's this curse to think about it as well, because it can consume your entire existence. And it can become a fixation to some point where you just become paralyzed by it. And you're not doing things that you love, because you know no one here gets out alive, regardless if you believe in climate change or not. So it's a tough situation to be in. We call it a predicament, and it's a no-win situation. So, Guy, we have a caller?
Well, yeah, and I just want to make a side point, Stephanie, that you think it's insulting to talk about us as a virus, and I agree, it's insulting to viruses everywhere. We do have a caller, Ray from Seattle. Are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here. Thanks for taking the call. Guy, I want to ask you a couple of questions. I saw a video of Paul Beckwith showing that there was a study in February 2017 that was done that said that methane really isn't a problem, and Paul Beckwith said scientists who say that we have less than 10 years, that's not really good science, you can't say that, there's no truth in it, or whatever. And the second question I had, I saw David Wasdell in a video from 2008 giving a rah-rah-rah speech, we can fix this global warming problem. I wonder what you think his thoughts are today, about 10 years later. So those are my two questions.
Good questions. Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for telling me they're good questions. I appreciate that.
The paper you're talking about was authored by Carolyn Ruppel, who works for the United States Geological Survey. The USGS has for years been treated by the heavy hand of the U.S. presidential administration and has been ordered to rein in the reality with respect to various impacts of the set of living arrangements on the living planet. In addition, people who have never written a single refereed journal paper as an expert about abrupt climate change. I generally turn to people who have actually been off a sidewalk once or twice, people like Peter Wadhams and Natalia Shikova, who have actually done dozens of expeditions on and beneath the Arctic ice, as opposed to Mr. Beckwith, who has not written a paper, has not finished his dissertation, and has, as nearly as I can tell, never been off the city sidewalk in Ottawa. So I'm not sure he's a reliable source. I'm not sure the USGS, that the single paper they put out relatively recently is a significant enough source to overturn dozens of referee journal articles indicating an ice-free Arctic in the very near future, as well as satellite observations indicating the same thing. And also the abrupt ongoing increase in atmospheric methane. Now, with respect to your second question, what would Wasdell say a decade later about fixing climate change? Well, and I think Mike agrees with this, that climate change is a predicament. It's not a problem. A single paper by the aforementioned Ken Garrett from the University of Utah, written in 2007 and actually published online in 2009, taken out of public view immediately thereafter because it was so insulting to scientists that their precious civilization would be threatened and that the only way to avoid runaway climate change was to collapse civilization. So the paper was published over a year and a half before it was officially published in February 2011. By this time, it was written 4 years earlier, and it points out that climate change, anthropogenic climate change, is a predicament, not a problem. Problems have solutions. Problems in the math book have solutions. They're typically found in the back of the book. Predicaments don't have a solution. So we're in this awkward position of we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. If we terminate the reconcilable heat engine known as civilization, if we terminate that, the planet warms even faster, up to a 3C global average temperature rise as a result of the acts of global dimming, the removal of the sulfates from burning poor quality coal falling out of the sky. And that leads to an abrupt rise in global average temperature up to more than 4.5 C above baseline. So we can't keep it going. We can't turn it off. We're damned if we do and damned if we don't. So I think Wasdell was being pretty optimistic back then, pretty optimistic today.
So what's his thoughts today?
You know, I haven't followed his work for a couple of years now, so I can't tell you what his thoughts are today. He has done some excellent work collating and integrating the work of others, but I haven't followed his work for the last couple of years, so I don't know what he would say today.
Oh, okay, because 10 years ago, like I say, he was giving that rah-rah-rah speech, we can do something. And it's like, well, it's about 10 years later after that speech, I'm wondering if he's going humming and humming and humming. Well, you know, it's like, well, it's all over. James Lovelock in that video saying he gave up, but he hasn't, but this guy hasn't given up.
Right, and the Arctic Methane Emergency Group are still cheerleading, too, based on the three-legged stool of ignorance of maintaining the omnicidal heat engine of civilization. So, you know, I meet very many people who are out there who are going to draw a paycheck who are saying we need to collapse industrial civilization. And I just don't see that as being a viable mission for people who are employed within industrial civilization. And, you know, the evidence indicates, as I already said, that at this point, it's maintain the omnicidal heat engine we affectionately refer to as civilization, or collapse it and then the heating occurs that much faster. So pick your poison, but at this point you got to know it's poison or you're not paying attention.
You know, I really appreciate you clearing up my first question, because the government agency that you said, GISS or whatever it was called, under government pressure to tone things down a bit. So that explains a lot of why they're saying methane ain't a problem.
Well, almost essentially all of those government sources are not within the judiciary branch, are not within the congressional branch. That means they fall under the onus of the presidential branch, the one of the three branches of the United States government. And so the United States Department of Agriculture, the United States Department of Interior, under which the United States Geological Survey is housed, those are parts of and answer to the president, presidential administration, just like the Department of Energy, just like the Department of Housing, and so on. So these secretary-level positions, and I think there are 13 or 14 of them, respond directly to the United States president. And those secretaries include housing and urban development, defense, interior, agriculture, and so on. So at some point, you follow the money or you follow the power, and you recognize that there's not much difference between the money and the power at this point.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your call, Ray. We appreciate your call. Okay. Stephanie, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're working on next and kind of what you're up to?
I got my guitar in here and, just little technique as I see it. And I'm writing a song about the moon from the other side, and it's just another Sunday night. It's just two songs that I'm having in preparation, so to speak. And yeah, but to be honest, with all this climate change happening, my man and I are also wanting to find a place and grow our own veggies and fruit and start self-sufficient living. And we also hopefully gonna catch up with Kevin Hester in Oakland at some stage. And yeah, so that's what's happening at the moment.
Well, absolutely. That sounds fantastic. Guy, do you have anything left for Stephanie?
Well, yeah, I think that's great. And further evidence that you of a person who recognizes the predicament that we're in, recognizes where it came from, and you still haven't foregone action. You're still out there doing something. I hear this all the time, that I'm telling people to roll over and die and accept their fate because everybody dies anyway. And
yeah,
obviously that's not something I've ever done, no matter how many times I read it. So I appreciate that you're not following that path as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Stephanie, for your time, and please feel free to share your music and work with us, and keep in touch on you can keep in touch with us on our Facebook page. I know we're Skype friends now, so keep us updated on what you're doing, and best of luck to you and Scott.
Thank you, Mike, and I'm very sorry about yesterday's mess up.
No worries. It can be confusing. I mean, you're across the world.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, thank you, Guy and Mike, and definitely keep in touch.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Bye. All right, we have another caller. We have Jay from San Francisco. Jay, you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you great.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just getting my headset on there. I've been listening to your program for a long time. Of course, very emotionally affected by it. And I've worked in the solar industry for like 10 years. And a big interest of mine has been, doing this for environmental purposes, for some kind of a solution. I wasn't really involved in climate change. I was mostly doing it from the pollution point of view. And but then I came across Mark Jacobson's work. I imagine you guys have thoughts about that. And so I just wanted to get, you know, lay it out here in two sentences and then get your take on it. So he's basically saying we have the infrastructure, the technology, the capacity, the economics are all in place to basically build it within 15 years. And because of politics, it'll probably take longer. If you look at the news, we are, it appears, on the bottom of an S-curve because solar is now cheaper than coal, and India is going gangbusters, China's going gangbusters. It's cheaper than nuclear and so forth, so I don't think nuclear is really going to go much further. And even if it doesn't save the species, it does slow it down. The demise, every bit that we replace, it isn't negative. It doesn't create more emissions than it takes out. It actually does reduce what is currently the status quo. I mean, still industrialization, yes, but still it's possibly sustainable. I guess that's the long debate that you guys are making. So I just wanted to get your take on all that.
Thanks for the question, Jay.
Okay.
Thank you, Jay. That's a fascinating series of questions that make me want to put a gun to my head, but I won't do that. So if you hear that loud noise, that was me. Mike, you can take over at that point. This is a funny thing. See, I'm not trying to be funny, but everybody laughs at me when I'm on the road, too.
It's your delivery.
Apparently so. So Mark Jacobson at Stanford, I'm quite acquainted with his work. He thinks in 15 years we're going to turn this ship around. Well, that's 15 more years of 150 to 200 species being driven to extinction every day by civilization. That's 15 years we don't have, because I can't imagine there will be a human being on the planet in 15 years, much less maintaining civilization. Remember, 1 degree Celsius above baseline was the absolute upper limit before we started triggering self-reinforcing feedback loops. Well, we're well over 1 degree C, and we have been for a while now. And we still keep trying to hang on to that political target introduced by an economist of 2 degrees C above baseline. But anybody who's paying attention knows that that's lunacy, that 2 degrees C is not safe. In fact, that's probably the upper limit at which we've had humans on the planet. Our favorite species, Homo sapiens, 1 degree C above the 1750 baseline. So, again, you know, trying to keep the game going, trying to keep the balls in the air, the plates spinning, which we use, so that we can continue to bask in the privilege of industrial civilization. Well, failing to recognize
devouring 200 species a day. I mean, it's a privilege to devour apparently 200 species a day. It's all about I get to be exhausting, and I can hear it in your voice. It's still all about us.
Yes, you heard that in my voice.
I picked it up. Yeah.
I can't imagine why other people don't hear this in my voice.
Again, I think it's the delivery.
Nuclear. Nuclear, for God's sake, was Three Mile Island not enough? Was Chernobyl not enough? Was the little inconvenient incident 5 years ago at Fukushima, was that not enough? We need more nukes? I want to tell you where to put the damn nukes, but I can't say that on the air.
Yeah. I mean, I have a solar panel, and I use solar, and I get it, but, you know, it's one of these things that it's the – it's a negotiation. It's a bargaining tool. It's something to keep the ball rolling and to make us feel good about keeping the ball rolling, which is rolling over everything and flattening it. So, you know, I don't see the point of promoting solar or promoting anything else that has to do with keeping this economy going in any way, shape, or form. Because it's ecocide, and that we can't say it any more simpler than that. We've been saying it for 103 episodes, and still, we're in the bargaining era or bargaining phase of denial. So it is exhausting.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me in exhaustion, Mike. We're gonna have to lay down together.
I'm gonna take a nap after the show.
Yes, I mean, it is bargaining. It's more of the same. And I've lived off-grid for 8 years now. I took all those actions that I thought would be relevant to allow the human species to persist, to maintain the set of living arrangements known as civilization. I did all that, and I grew a bunch of food for myself, and I had the goats, and I made the cheese from the goat milk, and I grew the orchard. So you were part of the whole project, and yeah. And the machine did not even slow down, much less yeah. stop. The machine ran over us, and we're roadkill at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, those things that we did together and those projects and where it's gotten us today, those things are very rewarding. And I'm not disparaging people from doing them, attempting them, but they're not going to do anything on a global scale. They'll make you feel better. They'll make your life better. You'll have a higher quality of life than pursuing some shit job sitting in traffic. I mean, and those are the reasons you should be doing those things, not to survive or to push the economy along or anything else like that, but because it feels better to live amongst people who care about things and who are doing things besides, producing some sort of service or shitty product. Those are why, you should pursue the set of the living arrangements that you and I are doing, not because it's going to save anything. And I feel good about what I'm doing, and my life feels better, and I feel better, but we're fucked. It doesn't matter what the fuck I do.
No, you're right. We've triggered all those self-reinforcing feedback loops. It's game over. Global dimming alone, if we were to stop this set of living arrangements, if we stop burning coal at scale, then the absence of global dimming alone would be enough to doom our species in the very near term. It's game over. We're done. We do all those things because they're the right thing to do. They're what we might call right action, and they do make us feel good. And even if everybody did them, we're still fucked. So get over it. Do what makes yeah. you feel good. Do what you think is right. Don't think you're going to affect anything. And the best thing I've been called in the last 10 years is what I just called myself. I don't see any way around this.
No, you've been accused lately of not mentioning the negative feedback loops that could counterbalance, like Jay brought up, things like, different energy systems and different pursuits. And again, that's bargaining on the highest scale I can possibly see.
Yeah. You call it the highest. I call it the lowest scale, whatever.
Yeah. But, that's what people are like, well, what if we do this and what if we do that? What do they think we've been doing for the last 12,000 years?
Yeah, we've been doing. If we had been humans being instead right. of humans doing for the last few thousand years, there might be some cause for hope about our
right.
future.
Right. But hey, that's the way it goes. So I don't know how much time we have left, but you got an interesting little thing about mass extinction in the Vatican. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, we are close to the end here. We've probably got about 3 minutes to go, and it takes a minute or two to wrap. So we did hear from our friend, Paul Marcotte, the Canadian. The headline is Mass Extinction, Vatican Embraces Science to Fight Biggest Threats to Humanity. Looks like the Vatican is going to invite leading scientists to discuss this topic. According to Paul, he did not see my name on the list. Oh, what a bummer that is. But at least they're going to talk about it, and they do report that in the wake of a mass extinction event, it takes at least 1.5 million years for the planet to start thriving as a green orb again. So that's not going to help us much.
All right. Good for the Vatican. How about you got something else from Judith Curry?
Oh, Judith Curry joins a long list of people, in this case, Georgia Tech, a long list of faculty members so heavily censored by her institution that she just can't take it anymore, so she's walking away. She joins me, Jason Fox at Ohio State, Camille Parmesan at the University of Texas, Peter Wadhams at Cambridge University, and now Judith Curry at Georgia Tech University. Among the people who have been so heavily censored, they just can't take it anymore. And she's a meteorologist. She's talking specifically about climate change. And the university does not want her talking about that. So sayonara from Judith Curry. Thanks very much, Dr. Curry.
Gotcha. Okay, well, we got a couple things. Guy will be touring the San Francisco Bay Area in late April through the 1st of May and then presenting in Missouri. And you can follow his coming events tab at guymcpherson.com for any more updated details. Anything else before I wrap up here, Guy?
Nope, that'll do. That's look forward to me on tour. That's all in the coming events, the events tab at the blog.
Okay, so that wraps it up for this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Past Last, and Progressive Radio Network. Join our Facebook group as well. It's naturepastlast.prn.fm, and feel free to post questions about that you want answered on the show, or send me an email, and I'll send them to Guy. You can find more of Guy's work at guymcpherson.com. You can follow me at The Good Men Project. My book, Chasing a Different Carrot, is now available online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Google Books. We'll see you on the radio next month, April 4th, 2017. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm and rate us on iTunes and follow us at Stitcher.com. Thanks for your call this week to Afrozin for his music. Thanks to Stephanie Sieven for her song. And until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Woohoo!